Let's chant the verse together, the prayer verse.
Om Nauna Vyakya Prakatita Parabrahma Tattvam Yuvanam Varshishtante Vasadvrishika Nairavratam Brahma Nishtai Acharyendram Karakalita Chinmudramananda Murtim Swatmaramam mudita vadanam dakshina murti nide.
Verse 9.
Buram bamsyanalo nilo baramaha. Buram bamsyanalo nilo baramahar. Nato himam suf puman. Natto himam shushpuman.
Sorry, I didn't made a mistake.
Natto himam shushpuman.
Natto
himam shushpuman. Itya bhati chara charatmakamidam. Itya bhati chara charatmakamidam. Yasyaiva murtyashtakam. Yasyaiva murtyashtakam. Nanyat kinchana vidyate vimrishatam. Nanyat kinchana vidyate vimrishatam. Yasmat parasmat vibhoho. Yasmat parasmat vibhoho. Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye nama idam. Shri Dakshina Murtaye. Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye Namah Idam Shri Dakshina Murtaye.
This is a lot of sandhi in this what, this top line. Buhu Ambhamsi Analaha Anilaha Ambhara. Oops, Ambaram Aharnataha Himamshuhu Puman Iti Abhati Chara Achara Atmakam Idam Yasya Eva Murtyashtakam Na Anyat Kinchana Vidyate Vimrishatam Yasmat Parasmat viboho. Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye nama idam Shri Dakshina Murtaye. Buhu means the earth. Buhu, the earth. Ambhamsi, the waters. So buhu, the earth, the water. Water in Sanskrit is always in plural. I guess you'd have to say like a little drop of water, singular, but water itself is in the plural. So, umbamsi, waters, analaha, the fire, anilaha, the wind, ambaram, space. Those are the five elements. Then, arhanataha, the sun. Arha means day. Nataha means the Lord. The Lord of the day is the sun name for the sun. So, Aharnataha, Ahaha's day, Aharnataha. Himamshuhu, the one whose rays are cool. Himamshuhu, the moon. Puman, the person, a person. The jiva, really, in this case. So, these are what we call at the end of the second sentence. Murtyashtakam. This is the eightfold parts or the eightfold forms of Bhagavan, of Ishwara. And there are other upasanas, other descriptions of Ishwara, just the five elements or the five, but here it's the five elements plus the sun and the moon and the jivas. So they're actually used for upasana. So you'll come across in upasana many different descriptions of Bhagavan, you know, like the earth is his feet, and the heavens are his head. These are all upasanas, and it goes all the way. They're beautiful, actually. But this Murtyashtakam, he's just making you visualize the whole universe, the five elements, the sun, the moon, and the jivas. So it takes care of the totality of your experience on the planet, so to speak. You can divide everything into these eight forms. And it's interesting, he adds the sun and the moon, because the sun and the moon is usually a symbol of the mind, and the sun is a symbol of the self, because the sun in this creation that lights up everything, because of which everything shines after the sun. So like that, everything shines after consciousness. So the sun is consciousness. The moon reflects the sun as the mind reflects consciousness. So that's why these are often used. So the five elements, the sun, the moon, the puman, consciousness, the conscious being, is really the jiva within this, so within the creation. So iti, abhati, chara, chara, charatmakamidam, yasyaiva, murtyashtakam. He says, for whom this eightfold form, for whom indeed is this eightfold form, which is chara achara atmakam idam. Idam means this which is chara and achara, moving and not moving, movable and immovable things, not the atma for achara, but those things within the creation that are not moving. They shine. So this idam vishwam, this universe, which is now being kind of divided up into this eightfold form of Ishvara. So this universe in the form of these eightfold form, for whom, then it says, iti abhati, it shines, this universe shines in this eightfold form of moving and immovable things, and then it lists kind of the upasana as the five elements, and also the sun, the moon, and the consciousness, okay? Conscious being, jiva. So now he says, so visualizing all of this, including all of this in this creation, na anyat kinchana vidyate, there is nothing else, anyat kinchana, na anyat kinchana, there is nothing else, there is no other thing, vidyate, there is, yasmat, parasmat, viboho, there is no other thing than this parasmat, viboho. This is the name for Ishvara. There is no other thing than that one who is all-pervasive and who is paraha, supreme. Supreme means desha kala vastu parichedaha. The one who is limitless is paraha. And that paraha is the one who is really all-pervasive, pervades everything, and also is the one who manifests in this eightfold way as Ishvara. Right? So viboho means all-pervasive, but it also means the one who becomes diverse from the standpoint of maya. So we say there is no other thing than whom. Who, this one who is the Lord. Salutations to that one. Mm-hmm. To that one who is, how to say that in English? Salutations, tesmai, to him from whom there is no other thing. It takes the ablative, so we want to say, use the ablative, but really means there is nothing else other than this all-pervasive self that projects as this creation. Salutations to that one who is Dakshinamurti. That's why the yasmat, tasmat. So, it's an overarching, sweeping verse. Salutations, it would be like this. Salutations to the one, to this universe. Salutation to the one who is in the form of this universe, which shines, which are made of movable and immovable things, chara atmakam idam. This salutation is to the one who shines as this universe of this eight, of these eightfold forms, and which is made comprised of movable and immovable things, who is in the form of the earth, the water, the fire, the air, the space, the sun, the moon, and the reflection of consciousness for all of the jivas. So that actually, if you see that with the chara and achara, when you're including movable and immovable, will include the sattva and the tamas and the rajas. Immovable is the tamas, right? Movable is the rajas. Puman, the one who reflects consciousness, is the sattva. And so that sattva, rajas, and tamas, which is there abiding in the jiva, and all of the nama rupas that are experienced. So the one whose being illumines all of that, right? That all of this shines after that one who is taking this form. Then it says, Nanyat kinchana vidyate vimrshatam. Vimrshatam. For those jnanis, for those who have viveka, vimrshatam means for those who have viveka, for those who know, for those who can see, for them, all of this universe that we experience shines after only that one non-dual self. Not only that, but when you say one non-dual self, it shines after that Paramatma. This universe is not a second. Brahman is one without a second. And here is this universe. So in order for this universe to be accountable, it has to be mitya. If one without a second, Advaita non-duality, is the truth, then this universe can't have a second being. Yeah? That's why, and when we say this universe, we can have to establish, a great part of this teaching actually is establishing the mityatva of this universe. And this universe includes all of these things. It includes sattva, rajas, and tamas. It includes movable, all movable. These are big sweeping things. The sattva in the universe, that which reflects consciousness or takes itself to be a conscious being, the jiva. All of the activity, all of the, in terms of the jiva, all of the prana in terms of the world, all of the activity, that's rajas. The tamas are all the nama rupas, the ancient forms that we can objectify through our sense organs. That's the tamas, what is responsible for nama rupa. So all of these things need to be analyzed to see if they hold any intrinsic reality. If you can find any type of being here in this creation that we, or find being that doesn't come from non-being, because being actually can't come from non-being. So if you're attributing beingness to something that is here now but has come into being and goes out of being, that thing is mitya, just by definition. Nothing can come from non-existence. You have to understand the use of the words here. Non-existence means it is not there. And so nothing can come from what is not there. And so the being that something enjoys can't just sprout up out of non-being. And we experience being in reference to, as kind of the invariable in every experience that we have. You never experience non-being because it's not there to be experienced. And so when we analyze this creation, there is nothing in the creation that is not bound by change. By the mere fact that it's bound by change, it's mitya. It has no being of its own, because change means what is here now wasn't here before. And when that changes, what is here now is now gone. And so even though we experience it as existent, we only experience it as existent when it is here. And that sounds silly and duh, but it's also the truth. When it is here, it exists. When it changes into something else, then that exists. When that changes into something else, then that exists. The existence is the invariable. And so we have to understand that fact, both in reference to the external world that I perceive through my sense perception, and the internal world of my mind, of my vrittis, of my inner experiences, of my moods and my emotions, they exist when they are here. When they're not here, there is no existence there to be found in reference to them. Existence remains steady. My existence remains constant. It's the invariable. But in my internal experiences as well as my external experiences borrow that existence, and then they, as they go on changing, the things that have changed are no longer existent, and what is there is whatever is being illumined by my vritti. The vritti which enjoys that conscious being. It's exactly the same for Ishvara. The whole creation is entire flux. Everything is in motion. Just like for me, if I analyze myself in the interior and exterior, everything is in motion. If you analyze the creation on any level, all of it is in motion. But whatever is there being experienced at that moment exists. But the existence is independent of the changes. That's why Swamiji calls this Maya an incidental attribute, because existence is what we call the adhishtana. It's the truth of what is there. The self that you're experiencing, the changes that your experiences have as their self, me, consciousness. Consciousness is their self, not the namarupa. The namarupa is continually negating itself. The same for your mind. You are there. This is my mind. These are my feelings. But actually, no. Yourself is always exactly the same. And your mind, your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions, unconscious processes that come up to consciousness, all of those come up and take place illumined by your being. And now by illumined by, I mean the consciousness that you are, the self-evident consciousness that you are, right? With the mithya, whatever is there happening in the mithya, from the standpoint of you as a jiva or from the standpoint of the whole Ishvara Upadhi, that is known because the self is known. That becomes evident. That becomes known, not in its own right, but it becomes known because it's enjoying for its being the self. When something changes, an experience changes, then that new experience enjoys, has for its being the self. The prior condition is gone. It's like the prior moment of right now. This sometimes kind of freaks people out, but it's true. Right now, if I just assume that right now I'm experiencing one moment, which isn't even true. This one moment, whatever you're calling one moment, is really a long period of time in terms of the kind of the infinite regress of divisibility. But say I just say this moment right now, this is the present. Boom. This is what we're going to call this is the present. It's already gone. Whatever you're experiencing right now in the present, it's past. It's gone. Because everything has changed even subtly. There's nothing here that remains the same. We don't experience it that way because the adhishtana, the self, is constant. It's the invariable. So for me, the actual material cause, the vivarta upadana karana, which never, as consciousness, never goes through any change at all. So just because these subtle little things are taking place that kind of change the experience moment to moment to moment, that I don't even notice it because their being is changeless. That's the invariable. I am the invariable. So changes are taking place, but no change is taking place. Changes are taking place in the mithya, but no change is taking place in the self, which is actually what is there. You know, like, just keep thinking of the clay pot if you want to understand satyam mithya. If you have a clay pot, the pot is not really there. There's only clay. Only clay. We experience the pot, but only clay is there. That's satyam mithya. Mithya means we can experience it, but when we go to discover its being, it's the invariable clay, it's the invariable me. And really, I am the only thing that is there. And so because I am changeless, the consciousness is changeless, this me is ever present, change is not even noticeable, really. It's not really even noticeable because the self of what is changing is not changing. So this whole Advaita Vedanta is Satyam Mitya. So the one who has this vimursha, the one who has this, for those who have this viveka, for those who have this self-knowledge, really, he says, the only thing there is the Paramatma, is the conscious being, which is myself, but this self has been released from its identification, its oneness with my body and with my mind and with my sense organs. All of these things are continually changing, moment to moment to moment, and all the external world same, continually changing moment to moment to moment. I have identified myself with these things that are changing until I have the viveka, where I can discriminate, I can recognize in one and the same place the changeless and the changing. The changing has no being to be apart in any way from the changeless, because it has no existence. If it's away from, there's no away really, but if itself changes, I mean, there's no way to get away from consciousness. It's non-dual. It's a different order of reality. It has consciousness, conscious being is ever present. I am ever present. My being is ever present, you know. But the things that change come and go, come and go, come and go, come and go, come and go. But they come and go in me who am changeless. Mitya means we experience them, but they have no being at all. And so, as all these things are changing, nothing is happening to me. The dream is a good drishtanta. Everything seems so real in the dream, as you're characterized, as you're identified with the dream character. You're experiencing the dream. There's a 100% Brahma delusion there, because you are part, everything that is experiencing the dream is part of the dream. And so everywhere you look, you know, you exist in that reality. You know, and there's subject-object relationship. You could pinch yourself in the dream. Even in Gaudapada, in the Mandukya, the fourth chapter uses this example. You pinch yourself in the dream. Okay? And it hurts. Because it hurts, this has to be real. You know, if I lift up this chair in the dream, this chair is really heavy. It has weight. It has to be real. You know? But upon analysis, it has a reality within itself. It has reality within itself. It has, you know, it has color, it has weight, it has dimension, you know, there are experiences, there are emotions, all of the components of Ishwara, really. On a subtle level, you have all of the components of Ishwara, of the whole Maya Upadi, on an Ulpa, on a small level, on a finite level. Where for Ishwara, all that exists is part of one infinite Upadi. But that infinite Upadi is just as much mitya as your Upadi. There is no difference at all. Mitya is mitya. Okay, so, as I realize that, the one who has that viveka, what is my experience? I'm experiencing this creation. I'm experiencing inside and out this creation. And at the same time, nothing at all is happening to me. That viveka is there. It's a beautiful thing, because it doesn't matter whether the experiences are positive or negative. It doesn't cover myself. It doesn't change myself. Mitya is mitya. See what I mean? If it's mitya, for you to say it's mitya, for that mitya to be a real word, it means that you have recognized the changelessness of your being in the midst of this changing universe. The changelessness of your being amidst the changing mind, amidst the changing emotions, amidst the changing experiences, happy experiences, negative experiences, tumultuous experiences, difficult experiences, happy experiences. Fine. They're all what they are. A happy experience is a happy experience. A negative experience is a negative experience.
But not the self is not participating in that. And so no matter what the experience on the level of the cosmos, on the level of the whole creation, the level of the country, on the level of the town, on the level of the family, and the level of your body, those experiences, positive, negative, neutral, whatever, there's a whole spectrum of how you're going to rate the experience, positive, negative, neutral. But the one for whom all of those experiences are is always whole and complete. It's always just me. And so the jnani, the one who has that knowledge, recognizes the self, this me, also, as the very one who is the self of the Lord, who is the self of Dakshinamurti, who is down the form of my teacher. That this very self that I am is the self that Ishwara is the self that you are, is the self that all beings are. And that self is from its own standpoint, a blessing. It's a blessing. The Atman, the self, is a blessing. That's why when you're, as yourself kind of unwinds from all of its issues, if the Vivek, this is, I like this part too, I like it all anyway. But when your mind starts to, initially with this knowledge, you come to this knowledge with whatever baggage is there, we all have our own unique set, you know, of issues and the things, the hurts and joys and whatnot of the mind. All of them are there. We all come to this knowledge with that, you know. And the initial blessing is the viveka, the where your being is recognized and your being is a sanctuary for those issues. Because those issues are blessed or loved, not as a verb, but as the very nature of the self. Whatever the issues are, they take place in yourself, whose nature is something whole and complete and beautiful and full, whole, not hurt, stable, the one who can really just welcome whatever the issues are. It's a big thing to have a inner sanctuary where you can welcome. Your mind can just welcome, kind of dive in to your own being and just naturally be healed by the fullness, wholeness, love, non-rejecting, absolutely non-rejecting nature, absolute welcoming nature without words, without verbs, not as a verb, but just as who you are. So there's a tremendous safety where the mind can just take refuge in your being. The mind that still has hurts and issues and things that have to work out over the years. There's no, what do you call that, shakti pot or something? All is well. No. There is that. Sometimes when you're with kind of a powerful teacher who's very, or even with bhajans and singing and so much shraddha, it makes for just a very dynamic situation. You feel great clearances and all of that. But that's just that. We used to feel that kind of thing with Swamiji also, or just the power of this knowledge. There can be these great, great clearances and this feeling of love, and you feel like you're enlightened until you walk out the door. You walk out the door, you get kind of by yourself, you know, on your own, and all of a sudden your enlightened mind goes... And you're sort of, oh no. You know, oh no, I thought everything was over. I thought I was full and complete now. It's all vrittis. You're having a very deep, profound vritti, you know, that is just mirroring yourself completely and just incredible, maybe a deeper vrittis than you've ever had before. They're very, very beautiful, but they are vrittis, and vrittis go away. Emotions go away. So say, because of the strength of the teaching, which is really very powerful, or the strength of the unfoldment, or the bhajans, or whatever atmosphere of the shraddha and the love that's being created, there's such deep absorption, so wonderful to experience. But if you think you're enlightened now, because you've had this profound experience, you'll be kind of shocked. Mm. as your mind starts to reemerge back into the to what it was. It takes time. It takes knowledge. It takes understanding. It takes having all of these issues that we have, these complexes and these unconscious hurts, all of the things that we are that we bring to this knowledge, it takes time for even your buddhi, as you gain this knowledge and gain clarity, your buddhi itself has to mature and be able to hold all of these things, you know, in a loving way, in a welcoming way, where you can actually be to all of those unconscious material and just habitual ways of reacting in the world. You can be to all of those as kind of what Swamiji says, a friend, a philosopher, and a guide. Philosopher means Vedanta, you or Vedanta, or psychological wisdom, you know. How to hold these emotions and these hurts in such a way, or these reactions, and all of it. We all have plenty of it, you know. We have to learn how to be with that in such a way that they can grow and release their pain. The pain's all stored in the body. Really, you feel your body releasing so many emotions and hurts and things. And that process is not an overnight process. And so even for your own, the shanti of your mind, a lot of it has to do with these unconscious things, you know, coming up in someone who loves them and understands, is not non-critical and wants to help. That's the nature of yourself, the buddhi, having differentiated you, has you, your being, as its sanctuary, and then that sanctuary, your unconscious material and your hurts and your angers and all of these things come up into that. And the buddhi knows how to be with that in a way that is not how, in a way that is different than how you grew up, or different than how your parents treated you. Like, what if you had really critical parents? Say your parents were critical, or they were demeaning, or they looked down on you, or whatever it is. It could be all kinds of things. Say they were doing that as you grew up. What happens is, as a little child, you introject those voices. And then without even knowing it, you're critical to yourself. You did that way. That was so stupid, you know. Or you could have done better than that. Because that's what you got out. Nothing's ever good enough. You're never good enough. Because from your parents' viewpoint, you're never good enough. So yeah. So the voice is, yeah, you're never good enough. You're never good enough. You're never good enough. You didn't do this right. You didn't do that right. You could be better. You could be better. You could be better. You know? And I'm never good enough to be really loved. I'm never good enough to be really wanted. These are all the childhood conclusions. And they just stay in place. They stay in place and nothing happens. And you know what? They're going on chattering away, these little child conclusions, and you don't really even hear them. Even though you don't pay any attention, because they've been chattering away from when you were really tiny. Whenever you learn to talk, you know, or you ever learn to understand your parents, that's the, like the superego or whatever you want to call it, that becomes an embodied way of being, you know, of being toward yourself. So these things all have to come into consciousness so that you recognize them, and they have to come into a buddhi that now is speaking and being and feeling toward you, toward your mind, toward your body, toward your complexes. It now feels and acts toward you much differently, you know, in a way that it would be wonderful if you were raised that way, but you're raising yourself that way now. Right? The buddhi is re-raising all of these unconscious hurts, and they all transform and change slowly and gradually, you know, in the light of your love. And so, and then what happens is that the easiest ones come up first, you know, not the hardest ones. The hardest ones need the buddhi to be the hardest, most hurtful ones. They need the buddhi to be stronger. So first you get the little easier ones that are hard for you, but then you learn, you get used to just being with them, welcoming them, not being afraid of those feelings. You realize you can handle those feelings. Feelings that maybe you thought you wouldn't be able to handle, you have to remember that you handled them when you were little. You handled those feelings when you were little. You can certainly handle them now, and when you open yourself up to experiencing that, you realize I can be with those feelings. Then Bhagavan says, okay, well, let's try these then. Let's try these, this next little more difficult ones. But then, because you could handle the previous ones, you're stronger. So then the next ones that come up, those are difficult for you, but you're stronger than before. And so in the same way, you realize that you can be with those feelings and you can welcome them and you're not afraid to experience them, you know. And you can be like a friend, philosopher, a guide, or a good mother, or you can be a guru to them in a way that then they feel loved. And a lot of the hurt and pain that they're carriers of get released in that welcoming and in that love, because it's a relaxation that takes place because of the love. The mind relaxes, and in relaxing the mind, the body that's holding it also relaxes, and so you get some release from all of this stress that's being held inside, that is usually just spilling out on everybody else because it's something triggers it, you know. Now as you get stronger and learn how to be with those experiences, when something triggers it, you recognize it and you go inside to hold it, rather than just immediately going after the trigger. It's absolutely normal to go after the trigger until you know, because that's what caused that's what hurt me, because that, in a way, it's true, that was the reminder or the trigger that went inside and touched that very painful area and made it kind of explode and overwhelm everything. But you learn by through teaching and then through practice that when you get triggered like that, time to go and be with the one inside who is hurt. And that's where the problem is. The problem isn't really solvable outside. You have to go to where the hurt or the anger actually is. You could say something like, wow, look, you're really angry. You're really, really angry. Tell me what that's about. But the one who speaks that to you has to love you. If the one who speaks that to you, tell me what that's about, is like this. There you go again. Go to your room. But what if that's not how you are at all? What if you have compassion and love for your little child? You know? Like you would for a little baby child, 2 or 3 years old, just so upset, so angry. If you're a normal person, you know, you would kind of be there and want to listen, want to help and hold your child and be present and figure out what's going on, let them tell you all about it, their big long story about the whole thing. And then if you can give that, the child would be happy and run off, it's gone. Very similar here. If you can give that to what's going on, you know, it can release so much, just so much. And then your mind becomes able to do that to the issues that come up in our psyche. We know how to be with that. And then, as you get stronger and stronger, it doesn't really matter if the issues are coming up externally, some issue out here, or internally. You're kind of with it in the same way. Because you've learned that. And you recognize yourself that's not the self, that's not really changing at all. That's why it's a refuge. And the buddhi, enjoying the ananda, the wholeness, the beauty of your own self, is able to handle what's going on out here. And if you can't handle it, then you can be with the one who can't handle it. Right, so you can't handle somebody said something, or this happened, or this happened, and things are chaos. You just can't handle it. And so then you say to your own buddhi or mind, look it, you can't handle this. Tell me what's going on. Same. It's the same. It's learning how to be with your experience. Yeah? So learning all of that is part of it. It's part of this knowledge because these things are there to be dealt with. So for the antakarana shuddhi, this is all antakarana shuddhi. How do we deal with our hurts and our pains and our complexes and our insecurities? They have to be dealt with in order for the mind to really be able to enjoy my knowledge. And also, just to make this really clear, it does not matter that you're having some big, huge reaction. You can't help that. If you could help it, you wouldn't have the reaction. Yeah. Simple. You would not have the reaction. So what matters is how you're with it. How are you with it? How do you hold it? How do you talk to it? How do you process that? You know? You can process it like a samsari, but you're not a samsari anymore. So if you're processing it like a samsari, you can say, look at what you're doing. You're processing it just like a samsari. But you know what? You have some knowledge and you have those tools and they might become operational a little later than what you would hope, but that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. They become operational, that way of being with yourself or being with your reactions, as soon as they are able to. You know? Like you can think, wow, I should have been able to do that. I should have been able to be kind and, you know, and loving and caring as soon as that happened. And I was not able to do that. So there comes the critical voice, and you can say, that's right, you weren't able to do it, but you were able to do it. You weren't able to do it right away, but you were able to do it. That's a wonderful thing, you know? Really, honestly. So I like to use, you know, I used to play the piano. I had to. My mother made me. So I'd have to sit there for at least half an hour practicing the scales, you know? The C scale, the D scale, the E scale. So practice, practice, practice. And, you know, eventually if you practice, then you can do it. And you can do it with both hands, back and forth, back and forth. You can do it perfectly. But you cannot do it perfectly the first time. And sometimes the second time and third time. And sometimes you spend, you know, a few days working on it. But eventually you can do it. Now, what if you were upset from the beginning every time, from the first time on, you were making mistakes? For the first time you tried it, you made a mistake. Second time. But what if you understand the process? You just keep working at it and working at it until you have it. You know, it's not about I'm supposed to be perfect the first moment. I'm supposed to be a great musician as soon as I sit down to learn the piano. You know? What about gaining a certain mastery over your mind and your reactions and your unconscious? Do you think that's an instantaneous, as soon as you get some inkling of it or some understanding of it, okay? It's not like that. That's a growth process. The beautiful thing is that once you understand that, then every time that you do it, it becomes better and stronger because the doing of it is so rewarding. Mm. So even though you can't catch it right away, you will catch it. And later, because it's so rewarding, you like to catch it earlier. And then later on, you don't even want anything to come up at all because I like my mind to be free and with myself. And so if some issue is coming up, it's going to come up into the one who doesn't want to go with that, but the one who wants to be with it without losing yourself. And so the reactions are just not worth it. I would rather it's not worth it to my own shanti. I don't really get anything out of it. I do get something out of, a lot out of, just allowing, welcoming it and being with it like you'd be with a child or with other people, learning how to be with them, you know, with their, with whatever their problems are and their angers toward you or this. Those things are difficult. But with practice, you can do that because it's so rewarding. You know, say somebody is mean to you who, or has hurt you in one way or the other, and so it's all, you know. I hope that face looked good. But what I'm saying is it takes some strength to, when you've been offended or hurt in some way, you know, to let that posture go, because the trigger, the trigger is still taken to be the culprit, you know. And but even then, even if sometimes you know that's not true, you know it's not true, but still there's such a resistance to taking an action that will make amends, you know. I'm going to tell the story again. Let's see what time it is. Okay, I've got time to tell you the story. This is my grand old story of when it was in 1982, and we were giving a course at Sandipani, which is near Garberville. So we were giving this course, and I was the administrative manager at that time of the Course Swamiji's course. And so, and you know, you have a lot of administrative duties, and also you take a lot of flack. Just, I mean, anybody who's had administrative experience kind of knows kind of the difficulties that can come up there. But there was this one guru bhai, actually, who was also had administrative positions. But there was something between us that was really not good. Very negative relationship, and I could go on and on about all the things she did. but anyway, something about that relationship, I was just, you know how you get that burning in your heart? It was like, it was just really bad, really bad. And so I would just avoid her. If I saw her in the distance, I would just turn around and go the other way. I didn't even want to have any contact with her at all. It was just too painful, you know. And so I used to tell Swamiji about this because it really bothered me, because I was carrying around all of this pain and angst, you know, and I was not letting it go, you know, like, I would still leave. I would see her there and I would leave, but I was leaving with my pain, you know, and it was really bad. It wasn't a little. I mean, it was really awful. Okay. And so I went and I told Swamiji about it, because I used to tell him these type of things. And he said, you do one thing, because he knew also, by the time he knew that I had been carrying this for a while. So you just do this one thing. You just go up and say hello. Just that. No more. Just go up, say hello, and then go on your way. I can't do that. I can't, Swamiji. I can't do that. I was serious. I can't. I cannot do. I could never do. I cannot do that. He said, "You do that. You just do it. It's not that you can or can't do it. You just do it. Don't think about it. You just do it." And the resistance was like 100%. And so I thought about it. I would get a little closer and think about doing that. No way. I won't. It's like, I would rather be in this terrible pain than do that. You know? So I went back. I went back and I told him again. And he said, "You have to do that. You do that." He was very firm about it. And so after 2 or 3 days of this, these instructions, unfulfilled instructions from him, you know, I did go up. She was cooking in Swamiji's kitchen. A bunch of us had cooks. We cooked once a week or something. She was her turn. She was cooking. And so I walked from the living room of his house where he was staying. And I walked. I just walked along through the kitchen. And I said, hi, and kept walking. And he said, hi, and I just kept walking. Hi. But you know what? The whole pain was completely gone.
Wow.
Just by that one simple act. I am sure that it came back. You know, but it was gone completely. And that just was so shocking to me. That became for me, because this was an extreme situation, but the immediate release of so much pain just by saying hi, it broke it. And so then that became not just toward this woman, but in life it became a major sadhana for me. Mm. Because when I would freeze up like that, or you know, that is what I would do. And after I'd done it, well, over a period of time, it became like I'd done it for, I don't know, every time. Well, let's put it this way. Every single time after that I did it, it was much easier. Mm-hmm. And it was much easier because of the tremendous reward, the tremendous reward from doing that. And so when you find yourself, because I know that I'm not alone, I know that people get hurt, and then they carry that hurt around, and they are kind of avoid and stay away from and bad vibe the person with their, you know, to kill them with their bad vibe, and make sure that everybody understands how displeased I am with you and all of that. You know, we don't even think about it; it just happens. But when you try this out, just this simple, it is hard to do. The first or second, I mean, I had a terrible time doing that. The resistance was so much. But if you can just do that simple thing, the reward is so much that you realize this is a very important sadhana. It's really just another form of pratipaksha bhavana, where you just do the opposite of how you're feeling. And boom. So these tricks of the trade, these things we have to learn, these are tools that we have. You have to practice those tools, and once you practice those tools, they become yours. Right? Otherwise you have to remember about them, you've written them down somewhere, but you actually haven't practiced them. Maybe you haven't practiced being with the little ones inside. Maybe you haven't practiced, if you see a critical voice inside, say, you don't have to be like that anymore. Mm. You don't need to be like that anymore. And then be how you can be. How you can be loving, you can be caring. And then that one who's been carrying this burden of being the critical voice, which just in interject at when you're 3 years old or 2 years old, it's like that one who goes, oh, really? You know? It can give up that job. Because you're changing the way that you react to yourself. And then your mind becomes much freer to react to the world, you know, in a more timely way. We have to be patient. We have to be patient. So, well, that's a little addendum to the verse.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, that's yes. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om. Om.